In their report, the race between teacher wages and the budget, the Research on Socioeconomic Policy Group at the Stellenbosch University Economics Department has found that real spending on education per pupil has fallen by more than 10% over the last 10 years, particularly in the Free State, Limpopo and the Northwest. This has occurred as teacher compensation has ratcheted up at a faster pace than the total percentage increase budgeted for education as a whole over the years. This finding comes on the eve of a possible serious wrangle between teacher unions and the finance minister Tito Mboweni, who's set to table his COVID-19 readjustment budget on the 24th of June. To discuss some of their findings further, I'm joined on the line by Dr. Nick Spall. He's from the Research on Socioeconomic Policy Unit at Stellenbosch University. Thanks very much, Nick, for joining us. So your report talks about a level of fiscal squeeze in provinces when it comes to their spend on education. What did you find?
Sure. So what we did was we looked at the provincial spending on education over the last 10 years, so since 2008 to 2018, to try and compare how much has been spent on education, what's been driving that, and particularly what's happening to teacher wages.
Yes.
How much are teacher wages increasing compared to the budget, which is the reason why we called the report the race between teacher wages and the budget.
Mm.
And essentially what we're finding is that teacher wages have been outpacing budget allocations, which is causing that fiscal squeeze.
Yeah. So tell us about how provinces are reprioritizing expenditure and what some of the consequences of that reprioritization have been.
Sure. So we know that provinces have a lot of autonomy as to how they allocate the budget that they get from National Treasury. So they get a big allocation from the equitable share formula, but it's actually up to them how much they want to allocate to education or to health, etc. And what we've seen is that the way provinces are coping with having to pay teachers higher salaries but not having the additional budget to meet that expectation is basically that they're not hiring teachers and particularly school managers. So they're leaving when people retire or they leave or they die, they leave those positions vacant.
Mm.
So we're starting to see vacancies rise, particularly amongst principals, deputy principals and HODs, as a cost-saving mechanism, and this is particularly extreme in certain provinces.
Yeah. So you cite the Free State, Limpopo and the Northwest as provinces that have actually seen a real decline of over 10% per pupil in terms of the spend over the last 10 years. So in practice, what sort of impact has that had for learners in those provinces?
Sure. So I think that the most immediate effect for learners would be a rise in class sizes. So there was a birth spike that happened in 2005, which 6 years later led to an enrollment increase, which not a lot of people in South Africa know about.
Mm.
But there was a 13% spike in births in 2005, and this led to a rise in enrollments, and those people are now making their way through the schooling system. They're currently in high school.
Yeah.
But in order to counteract that, you needed to hire more teachers to keep class sizes the same.
Mm.
And because the provinces were under this fiscal pressure, they didn't hire more teachers. You actually saw a reduction in the number of teachers by about 2%. And this despite the fact that there was a rise in enrollment. So for kids, they would be experiencing increases in class sizes, which we also document in the report. And the second thing is that depending on which province they're in, if they're in one of the more heavily affected provinces, they would be more likely not to have a principal or not have a deputy principal or an HOD.
Mm. And of course, you know, just deducing from what you're telling us, this is negative for learners, obviously, because you've got a higher teacher-pupil ratio and it means the kids don't get the attention they need.
Yeah, that's true. And another thing that we also document and highlight in the report is that non-personnel funding is likely to also come under the squeeze. So I'm sure that your listeners will remember the Limpopo textbook saga from 2011,
yes,
where learners in Limpopo didn't get textbooks. That was basically because of a political decision in 2008, which was to accept much higher teacher wages agreements in the bargaining councils than had been budgeted for. So eventually the province basically ran out of money because it was paying teachers higher than it had budgeted for, and then it used the textbook money to pay the teachers' salaries, which is the reason why they ran out of non-personnel funding.
Wow.
So I think we are likely to see that in a lot of provinces as well, is using these kind of more discretionary funds to pay teachers.
You've basically found that the wages are the biggest cost drivers within the basket of costs that provinces have to deal with when it comes to spending on education. And of course, National Treasury is saying that it can't honour the final year increase of the 2018 wage bargaining agreement for the 2020-2021 financial year. Based on the work that you've done, do you understand why National Treasury says it can't come to the party in this regard? And given the mix of expenses for provinces when it comes to education, do you think ultimately that something has got to give?
So I'll start at the end of your question. I definitely do think something has to give. That's actually the conclusion from our from the report, which is that either we need to limit teacher wage increases or we need to increase budget allocations to education, but that the status quo is not sustainable. And I think that's something which Treasury is also recognizing, is that in order to balance the books, given the fiscal climate that we have and the amount of debt that we can take on, they have to figure out how to make those books balance. And I think that they're recognizing that the only way that they can do that is by containing the public sector wage bill. And basic education spending is the largest single line item in the budget, makes up 3.5% of GDP. And 80% of that is teacher salaries. So the entire question of saying we really need to control public sector wages, you can think of this teacher discussion that we're having as just a microcosm of the same thing. And I think that what's driving all of this is that the political decisions about wage negotiations, which are political, if we think of the ruling alliance between COSATU and the ANC, those are not being informed by the budget reality from Treasury. So it's almost as if what the government's left hand is doing is independent with what its right hand is doing, and that's not sustainable.
Not sustainable, but given where the country is fiscally right now, do you think government's promise that schools will soon, in the fullness of time, be highly geared towards the fourth industrial revolution, will there be any money for that if we do continue the status quo?
So I think that if we continue the status quo, it's not going to prepare us for the fourth industrial revolution anyway, because paying teachers higher salaries doesn't make them ready for technology or socio-emotional skills or the various other things that we think the new economy is likely to need. Those things require things like teacher training, pre-service teacher education, and reforms in those. And when we're thinking about the problems that we have at the moment, it's primarily around teacher salaries rather than non-personnel expenditure like training. So I think that this is, if we carry on with the status quo, even with the level of increases in basic education spending, because there have been massive increases in spending on basic education, it's just that the increases in teacher salaries have been even bigger.
Yes.
So I don't think that the solution to this is to say, we need to cut spending on education, even though I suspect that that is what's going to happen, which the government is going to find politically very difficult to implement, given how important the unions are to their
survival
as a constituent, exactly, and to their re-election. But it seems inevitable that they're going to have to say, as you mentioned, that they're not able to honor those wage agreements because there simply isn't money.
Yeah.
And until people can come up with solutions as to where that money is going to come from, whether it's increased debt or increased taxes or something like that, I suspect we're going to see more strikes and more labor unrest. Because there's going to be a disagreement between the union side of that partnership and government side of it.
Very interesting findings indeed. Let's deviate a little bit. I mean, it's taken some months for children to get back to school. In fact, they're still being phased in. And we know that this is a global problem, a global phenomenon, given the COVID-19 pandemic. But you were involved in a paper which basically says that it's actually imperative for kids to get back to school, and that, in fact, the risks of being harmed by COVID for people of school-going age are actually far less than other risks. You'll put me straight if I didn't, you know, quite correctly encapsulate that. But just unpack your thoughts on this issue for us.
Sure. So the report that you're mentioning is one that we released last week called Counting the Cost. And the aim of that report was to ask what is in the best interests of children in terms of school closures, although we also do look at lockdown. And what we concluded is that ongoing school closures are no longer in the best interest of children, and that all children should go back to school immediately. And the reason for that, as you mentioned, it was a good summary, that the additional costs, the kind of collateral damage to children of not being in school, is considerably larger than the risk, the additional risk that they would face by going to school. And that's driven by a number of factors. It's driven by the fact that children are at relatively high risk of other diseases and causes of illness that they might have. So, for example, pneumonia or diarrhea or HIV and TB. Those are much larger causes of mortality and illness in South Africa, even with COVID, than COVID-19. So if you look at and we compare the predicted number of deaths and severe illnesses that have been caused and are likely to be caused from COVID-19 compared to all of these other types of illnesses, and the COVID-19 illnesses dwarf in comparison. So even if you look at the total number of deaths in the whole country that are predicted in the worst case scenario, in 2020 in South Africa, which is 49,000 deaths, that's still less than 10% of the total number of deaths that we anticipate to happen in 2020 from other causes, which is more than 400,000. So it's not to say that any death is a tragedy and should be avoided,
of course.
But we need to ask costs. We need to ask questions about the costs and say, what is the cost and benefit of implementing this particular decision? Because it's not as if when we're implementing a lockdown and closing down all schools, the mental health costs to children, the nutritional costs to that, the fact that 8-9 million children are not getting free school meals, and that leads to increases in acute malnutrition, all of those are likely to be additional costs that we're going to be seeing for the next 10 years as a result of the types of policies that we're implementing in 2020. Hmm. And we were basically trying to foreground that to say we need to be asking serious questions about what's in the best interest of children and not just assuming that lockdowns and school closures are in their best interest.
That was Dr. Nick Spall from the Research on Socioeconomic Policy Unit at Stellenbosch University.